Friday, June 23, 2006. This is an oral history interview with Tom Gotkins. The interviewer is Reginald Carter. The interview takes place at the Eugene Stead Center in Durham, North Carolina. Tom, could you give me just a little background information about where you were born and raised, a little bit about your family and then your education?
I was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Actually did not do well in high school, didn't have a clear direction, and decided to go into the Navy. So I became a Navy corpsman and was stationed at San Diego for my basic training and Portsmouth, Virginia for the rest of my career.
Now, when was it that you were in the Navy? What years?
1961 through 1964.
64. Was it in the Navy that you learned about physician assistants, or did you come out and start working somewhere or go to school?
Well, I became very interested in the healthcare field. I liked administration, but I also loved healthcare, so I became a corpsman. And in the Navy, I did easy duty. They put me on the medical officer's ward for my first year at Portsmouth. But in my second year, I was on the neurosurgical unit and had to take care of a lot of critically ill patients. There was one in particular that came to mind where he was in a coma for 6 months. But when he woke up, he said, "Godkins, you shit." And ever since, I've said, there are miracles.
When was it you first learned about physician assistants and thought about applying to the program?
Well, I left the military. They wanted me to go on to do lab training or x-ray training, something like that, and left and went to Pittsburgh, worked in a blood bank, and then got admitted to Youngstown University in Youngstown, Ohio. And it was in my first year there that I saw the Look magazine article, read the article about more than a nurse, less than a doctor, and thought that was just the thing for me.
So you applied and was accepted the first year that you applied?
I applied and it was put on hold. And then out of the blue, Jim Moe wrote me back to say I'd be accepted if I'd work at the in the cardiac care unit for a year. And so I received notice to move to Durham in like November of that year, and I was told to be on duty before Christmas, but I packed up ship and went to Duke.
Okay, and so you did your year and they then took you into the program?
Yeah, worked at Duke for 66 to 67 and then went into the program in 67 and graduated in 69 with the third class.
Tell me a little bit about the formation of the American Academy. That occurred while you were in school? Or?
Yes, and Bill Stanhope really, I was a founding member, but Bill Stanhope should be considered the founding father. Right. And we formed it at Duke. I remember vividly taking classes in the residence quarters and then in the trailer. But with McQuarrie and quite a group of people, Whitaker was the first secretary, Stanhope was the president for the first 2 years. Myself and others, we kicked around the code of ethics, the bylaws. We had help from Duke, the Duke administration, including Duke legal counsel. I can't remember whether it was Ballinger at that time or
yes,
Martha. And so we formed the American Association of Physicians Assistants at Duke.
And you met initially in the Baker House, is that my understanding, to discuss getting up and running?
I think so, because we'd always be talking about it, and I think after class or at lunch, we'd do it. I think it was actually formed itself with a vote in the trailer.
Okay.
I don't know what year that would have been. I guess if I was in the program for the years 68 and 69, it was in there somewhere.
Yeah. There are some talk that Harvey Essie lent the money to the academy, and I think it was something like $50 to actually incorporate. Do you recall that at all?
No, that's correct. I think I heard that from either Roger or Bill Stanhope.
Yeah.
Because okay. The administration was always supportive. And the early, some of the early people affiliated with the program, John Braun and Carl Fasser, Jim Moe, Robert Howard, and then later, David Lewis, all very supportive of the association, forming the Academy Association at the time.
Now, tell me how you became president. How did that occur? You were the second president of the Academy, or third president of the Academy, I believe.
Yeah, the Stanhope was president for the first 2 years, and John Braun was elected president next, or at least elected in 72. And Stanhope and I had always talked about the fact that John Braun may have to go on from Duke to join the federal government, because he was very interested in going up to support the PA profession, because he was actually the guy handing out and reviewing the grants that were submitted by PA programs and making awards. So we had sort of discussed between us, why not have me run for vice president, and then perhaps someday if John has to go, I could be voted in by the board as president. And sure enough, that's what happened in 1972. So I was president during the 72 to 73 time frame.
And then you were elected again to the Academy presidency, and that was what, 3 or 4 years later?
Yes, in 1975, I was elected legitimately to the presidency and served from 75 to 76. Between all of this, between the two presidencies, for example, I was chairman of the Goals and Priorities Committee between and after I was elected.
Now, you also got involved in Oklahoma, and so you got involved in the Association of PA Programs as a faculty member, and you became president of the association. That was after your two presidencies in the academy, or?
That was after that, and in I participated in the APAP meetings on an annual basis and enjoyed that, and especially as I got more into the PA program world. And so I guess I don't quite know how I became president, except I must have been nominated. This one wasn't a done deal. This was out of the blue. I followed Archie Golden, a physician from Hopkins, who was a wonderful man. And so I was elected president of APAP for this term 79 to 80, and was the first non-physician PA president of APAP.
Oh, okay. One area that I'm really interested in is the mergers that were going on, or the proposed mergers. And I understand the pressure was on from the AMA and the federal government for that to happen, and that was pretty well made known to you guys. Both on the association side and the academy side, but everyone was going to have to come with one voice or no voice at all. Is that correct?
That's true. And I remember as president in each of these time frames, really doing a lot of correspondence. I do remember once that in one of my presidential years, and it was probably 72, that I was on the road 3 months in the air and on the road for the academy 3 months out of the whole year. And back in those days, the PA program had to pay for it. There was no travel budget for that. But where were you on that? Let's see.
Well, the merger and the correspondence indicates that there was this National Association of PAs, the Maritime Group, and then there was the college, which was out in Cincinnati, and they were well organized. But apparently they were not primary care. They were more surgical or orthopedic, urological PAs. Is that?
That's true. Yeah, and we were told from the beginning by, I wrote many letters to John Prophet, U.S. Secretary of Education, and Mac Detmer, who was with the American Medical Association at the time and involved in the beginning of the review committees and the accreditation of programs, that for us to be, the torch I carried then was that we wanted to be recognized and be on the Joint Review Committee, and we wanted to be a part of program accreditation. And they told us that we had to represent more PAs, because back then we only represented 50. We're talking early here.
Yeah.
And so I think we one of the national groups that was small kind of went away and didn't want to claim to be representative of PAs. The American College of PAs, we had a little go-around with them. They asked us if... the American College tried to play itself as representing all PAs. We wrote them and said, we represent all PAs. They made an offer, which I initially turned down, and then they wrote the AMA to try to be recognized on behalf of all PAs. Mac Detmer then wrote a letter saying, the two of you need to get together. So the American College and our association about to turn Academy, I think turn Academy, had met in Oklahoma City on two occasions and did merge. And that's when the Academy became recognized as the national organization.
Now the proposal, the counter-proposal, was to change the name to the American Society of PAs, have it headquartered in Cincinnati. And I believe they already had an office and someone they called an executive director. So from that point of view, they were a little more advanced, but it seems like it says a merger occurred, but if you read the correspondence, it looks like the college went under before a merger really took place, because is that your recollection? Did they just fizzle out at the end? Or?
Well, you know, it may have been, but my recollection was this, that they went away and that we offered them membership in the Academy.
Yeah, the newsletter said you took 138 of their members into you.
And then we never heard much about their association. So that could have happened, their college.
But do you think that was related to the fact that the AMA and federal government was pushing primary care rather than specialty? You might have...
In part, and the fact that they wanted the two of us to get together, and we represented the formerly trained PA. We had the Duke name, and other institutions were beginning to develop.
Yeah.
All of that, I think the U.S. Department of Education and AMA felt we were going over time to be the most representative of all PAs.
And the formation of the registry and the programs that belonged to that were pretty much the same programs that were now, their students were joining the Academy. So you were beginning to spread out to Wake Forest and Texas and Oklahoma and
Alderson-Broadus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you were growing through those programs
fairly rapidly.
Quickly. Yeah. Okay. So that was the major get together. Eventually, the medics people decided not to form a separate group and also join the Academy. Were you a part of that, or remember how that came about?
I helped foster it and facilitated it, promoted it. I thought that while it was a different training modality, and Bill Stanhope was very much of this bent too.
Mm-hmm. Was Steve Turnipseed on the medic side?
Yes, well, and we worked with Steve and talked to him a lot, and then he eventually got very involved in the Academy and went on joint review committee trips to accredited programs and the like. So we felt the medics was a different model, but a very legitimate model. And
when that wasn't really a merger, but when they decided not to form a group, you did put medics on your board, I believe, or said there would be at least one medics representative to begin with. So that's
right, and I think that just kind of gradually went away.
But, right.
Yeah.
Okay. And all the other organizations you really never did anything with, they just kind of died out after you and the college got together, is that right?
That's right.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about Roger Whitaker. Roger, was he in your class or before you?
Roger Whitaker was in the class with Bill and I in graduated in 69. He was the, we have a PA in North Carolina, of course, that practiced, and probably the first informally trained PA with Dr. Amos Johnson. And Roger really was probably the first informally trained surgical assistant in California, and both first and second assisted in surgery. In fact, Eugene Stead went to testify on his behalf when there was a complaint brought before the Board of Medical Examiners in California. And I don't know that anything bad became of that. Roger eventually applied to Duke and worked on the cardiac care unit with the rest of us.
And as I recall, Stead actually invited Roger to come and become formally trained so he wouldn't have legal problems in the future. So
that's correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
Roger did well.
Yeah, and then Roger became president of the academy, and then went to Oklahoma with you and Bill to help with that program. Or?
Roger went on to General Electric in Chicago.
Oh, okay.
And then Bill recruited him to Oklahoma, so Roger came to Oklahoma.
So both of you got recruited to Oklahoma.
Bill went from Duke to Alderson Broaddus, got his degree at Alderson Broaddus, and then came to Oklahoma.
Now, when you graduated, you worked, what was your first job as a PA?
Yeah, I was the first PA to be employed by the Mayo Clinic, Mayo Foundation. I was more or less an internal medicine and cardiology PA. Others at Mayo told me that they marveled at my skill, but you have to remember, I love cardiology, so I was sort of trained on the cardiac care unit by Andy Wallace. I took two rotations under Estes, one at the VA and one on the university side. So probably running counter to accreditation guidelines, I left Duke with many months of cardiology. And so I practiced there. The Mayo Clinic, in turn, was interested in starting a satellite clinic. So I had to be retreaded. I felt very uneasy about primary care. And so they trained me a little bit in primary care, OB-GYN, dermatology, acute illness service, and then put me in their first satellite clinic, which was in Plainview, Minnesota, about 28 miles from Rochester, Minnesota.
There was no state legislation at that time, or?
No, there wasn't.
And you just basically by custom and usage and regulatory authority, is that the way you work?
Correct. That's the way the Mayo Clinic saw it, customer and usage, same for reimbursement. They felt that I was doing things under the supervision of a physician, which I always was.
Was there a physician out at the satellite clinic during those times, or were you soloing a lot of the time?
Well, it's funny. I think it worked just like it ought to work for any PA. By the way, it was a converted two-bedroom bungalow. The two bedrooms were treatment rooms. The bathroom was the specimen. The kitchen was the lab. I did my own lab. The garage was x-ray and EKG, and yeah, the basement was the x-ray developer. So I took the films. Today, this is frowned upon. I took the films out of the machine, took them down and developed them downstairs, looked for gross problems, afraid that I would miss something though. But the x-rays always went to Rochester that night. But I started with, I started with probably 90% supervision, let's just say 4.5 days a week, or 4 days a week. And by the time I left, it was 1/2 day a week to see the new patients I saw who were returning and any acute case problem that I was a little concerned about. And I loved primary care there. The people brought you apples and apple pie. And probably in that case saw you more than they needed to because they didn't want the clinic to go away.
Okay. And now this was where looking?
Plainview, Minnesota.
And this was
71 through 72.
Okay. And then you get recruited by Bill to Oklahoma, is that?
Yeah, many calls. I liked the guy. I knew where he was coming from. And so I was recruited to Oklahoma City, and I was, I think, one of those 1/8 VA, 7/8 university people, or vice versa. But I think the VA paid for my move, but I mostly worked for the PA program. But I always saw patients in hypertension and cardiology at the VA through 1983.
Okay.
Or 85. I've lost track of that. But so I practiced a good 15.
And then you went over to the chancellor's office or the provost?
I became more and more, you know, I went to Oklahoma because I was still fascinated about teaching PAs and becoming an administrator of a program. And then when I went to the program, I felt a little stuck. I was associate director for a long time. Stanhope went, the first PA was Stanhope, to go to the Robert Wood Johnson Health Policy Program. And he was tempted to stay on and do the Department of Defense forever. But he came back, so I was acting director. But when he came back, I started to feel like, well, can't do this forever, I don't think. So I did what most people would do. They got unstuck by, I started working on my master's in health administration in the College of Public Health. Something came up in the provost office that they were going to do a strategic plan and needed some manpower. And so I joined them and in 1983, I think, and went from assistant to the provost to assistant provost. And it was a little embarrassing because people on the campus thought I was a pretty fast riser on this thing. I joined them in 72, and here I am in 81 becoming, or 82 becoming an assistant provost. It was very gratifying and humbling. I mean, there were newspaper articles, which you haven't seen, but where I was named one of the top 10 administrators of the university and stuff like that. And I think you just have to work long hours. Now, I must say, my standard, even with the program, I had two secretaries that I kept busy full time. But when I joined the provost office, it was just one. But I've always worked about 60 hours all my life. And there was one week where faculty have to do, once a year you have to do a thing about your effort because of the federal grants. And one year, it was that week. And I did 100 hours. I was honest about it, but I flew to Washington to deliver a grant and all sorts of things for the provost office, so I counted it. And so I say to others, the most I've ever worked is 100 hours.
And then you are currently, your title and position?
Currently, Associate Vice President for Facilities and Director of Capital Planning. And so I moved in the provost office. I became less academic and more operations. So we decided to change my title from assistant provost for administration at the time, perhaps, to associate vice president for facilities management, director of capital planning. In that role, I'm responsible for all university space at the OU Health Science Center, particularly research space, because the provost controls research space. Been fortunate enough to manage over $200 million in capital projects, and am currently managing about $110 million. I'm in charge, not the total man in charge, but I am facilitating the OU Cancer Institute project, which is about $90 million, a new College of Allied Health building, which has risen from $20 million to $27 million total project cost just because of inflation. Mm-hmm. And then I'm in charge of a campus master plan, which is something why I'll meet with planning staff and AE services here at Duke this afternoon, because Duke is doing a master plan, and Greg, the campus architect, sent me an RFP. I incorporated some of that in Oklahoma, and so we selected an A&E firm and are in the process of changing our campus from about 300 acres to 600 acres.
Well, you've done quite well, Tom, and it sounds like the PA was a good place to get started in a career.
And I tell students, I still sit on the admissions committee of the PA program and give a lecture each year with Earl Dunkelberg, one of the first PAs out of our program, who's a real wonderful man, country bumpkin kind of guy. You just love the way he talks, and so I'm still tied to the program, but I tell the students every year, and I'm going to do that in about 3 weeks. I have many messages, but one is to really work hard while you're in the program. You can be an academician type PA, and you can get through the first year real easy, and then fumble in the second year when you don't apply yourself to preceptorships, or vice versa. Point is, you can come out of a PA program and not be employable if you don't work hard at it. And the second message is that when you graduate, if I can become an associate vice president for a major university, there's nothing that's impossible.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I appreciate you doing this tape for us. There's one other individual I'd like for you just briefly comment on, and that was Dick Shilley and his role in the early organization of the Academy. Do you have a sense of what that was?
Well, only that I wish I knew him better.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, he was a driving force on developing an organization. I mean, Stanhope sort of got carried the Shilley torch and got mm-hmm. the glory, but really Dick was interested so much in promoting PAs. He was one of the first three, and he wanted to form an organization. I wasn't close to him. I mean, I knew him and his wife, but it's a shame that his life had to end early. Okay. And it's a shame, I'm sure there are many others that you know, but it's a shame Roger Whittaker
mm-hmm. the same way
had to go early also.
Well, thank you again for the interview, and we'll end it there. Thank you.